A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
90% accuracy. That's how precisely a team watching couples argue in a lab could predict who'd be divorced 6 years later. And the thing they were measuring wasn't whether the couple fought. It was how. We have a special prompt today from Kira Lynn Kivist, a listener who works as a marriage counselor and, I'm told, knits sweaters for stray cats. Kira, welcome to the show. She asks, when a couple is having a rough time, whether it's recurring issues that keep flaring up or high-stress life circumstances making everything worse, how can they actually use the Gottman method to improve things? What it is, how it handles the recurring fight problem, what it does with external stress, and what specific techniques a couple could try tonight. So, let's get into it.
The first thing to understand is that the Gottman method isn't a communication seminar. It's built on 40-plus years of watching couples fight in a laboratory, and the man who built it came out of mathematics and statistics, not warm feelings. John Gottman was a professor at the University of Washington who started wiring couples up to heart rate monitors, cortisol samples, facial microexpression coding, and just watched. More than 3,000 couples. Every word during a conflict discussion coded, and from those patterns his team could predict divorce versus staying together with over 90% accuracy. That's not a self-help guru claiming he can read vibes. That's a behavioral model with predictive power.
So what did the model actually say? What's the house look like?
The architecture is called the Sound Relationship House. 9 components. The ground floor is Build Love Maps, which is knowing your partner's inner world, their stresses, their dreams, what they're worried about this month. Then share fondness and admiration, then turn towards instead of away, which is about responding to bids for attention. Above that, the positive perspective, then manage conflict, then make life dreams come true, and at the top, create shared meaning. And the whole thing is held up by 2 weight-bearing walls, trust and commitment. Without those, the floors sag.
9 components and 2 walls. Sounds like a house I'd nap in.
You'd nap in a collapsed tool shed.
Fair. But the interesting part for Kira's question isn't the house. It's what the research says about the fights themselves. What's the number?
69%. 69% of relationship conflict is about perpetual problems. Problems grounded in fundamental personality differences or lifestyle needs. These are the fights couples return to over and over, and they don't get solved. They're part of the relationship's permanent landscape.
So only about 31% of problems are actually solvable, which means the average couple's instinct, which is, we need to fix this fight so it stops happening, is wrong almost 70% of the time.
That's the counterintuitive core. A good relationship isn't one with no recurring fights. A good relationship is one where the recurring fights stop drawing blood.
Walk me through the 3 categories. Solvable, perpetual, gridlocked.
Solvable problems are situational. There's no deeper meaning underneath. House cleaning, for example, or how often to see in-laws. You can negotiate a chore chart or a schedule, and it's done. Perpetual problems reflect fundamental differences. One partner wants more order, the other doesn't mind clutter. One partner wants frequent contact with extended family, the other wants more distance. These aren't failures of communication. They're differences in personality and lifestyle needs. Gridlocked perpetual problems are what happens when a perpetual problem gets mishandled and calcified. The discussions feel like spinning wheels. There's a hidden agenda underneath, and almost always the 4 horsemen show up.
The 4 horsemen. Criticism, contempt, defensiveness, stonewalling.
Right. Criticism is attacking your partner's character, not the specific behavior. Contempt is the worst one, the one that predicts divorce most strongly. It's mockery, eye-rolling, treating your partner as beneath you. Defensiveness is responding to a complaint by counterattacking or playing the victim. Stonewalling is when one partner just shuts down, withdraws, stops responding. That's usually the physiological flooding piece we'll get to.
And each has an antidote?
Criticism gets the gentle startup. Instead of, you always talk about yourself, why are you always so selfish, it's, I'm feeling left out of our talk tonight and I need to vent. Can we talk about my day? Contempt gets building a culture of appreciation and respect. You can't just stop being contemptuous, you have to replace it with something. Defensiveness gets taking responsibility, even for a small piece. And stonewalling gets physiological self-soothing, which is the 20-minute break.
So the reframe is, for 69% of your fights, the goal isn't resolution. The goal is what exactly?
Dialogue with the right affect. The Gottman Institute says it directly. What matters isn't solving perpetual problems, but the affect with which they're discussed. The goal is to establish a dialogue about the perpetual problem that communicates acceptance of your partner, with humor, affection, even amusement.
Amusement. That's a high bar for the in-laws fight.
It is. But think about what amusement signals. It signals, I see this pattern, I see us in this pattern, and I'm not terrified by it. The fight stops being a referendum on whether the relationship survives and becomes a recurring feature you both handle with some grace.
And John Gottman's word for what you do to a gridlocked issue is decloring. Remove the hurt so it stops being a source of great pain. Not remove the conflict. Remove the hurt.
And the mechanism underneath gridlock is the part I find moving. Almost all gridlock conflicts stem from unfulfilled dreams. The perpetual conflict symbolizes a profound difference in personality and lifestyle preferences, and no one wants their most intimate relationship to block their dreams.
Give me the in-laws example.
So a couple fights about how much time to spend with one partner's family. Surface issue is scheduling. How often do we visit? How long do we stay? But underneath, one partner's dream is about family loyalty, being embedded in a multi-generational web, passing that to the kids. The other partner's dream is about autonomy, building their own household identity, not being absorbed into someone else's clan. The fight becomes gridlocked when each partner's position symbolizes a core value the other seems to reject. So it's not, you want to visit your mother again. It's, you don't think my need for independence matters. And the other hears, you think my family is a burden. Neither of those is actually what the other said.
So the dream detective exercise is about digging down to the buried dream and then negotiating around the dreams instead of the surface positions.
Right. Each partner contemplates what dream is buried inside the issue. Then you explain your position without criticism or blame. Then you soothe each other. Then you accept that some problems are unsolvable, and you define the minimal core areas you can't yield on, the areas of flexibility, and you devise a temporary compromise that honors both dreams.
Temporary.
Temporary. Because the problem is perpetual. You're not signing a permanent treaty. You're building a process for revisiting it without reopening the wound.
And Gottman's line about acknowledging each other's deepest hopes and dreams being the key to saving a marriage. That lands.
It does, and it connects to the other famous finding, the 5-to-1 ratio. Stable, happy couples maintain roughly 5 positive interactions for every negative one during conflict. The positive interactions are the buffer that lets you touch the perpetual problem without bleeding out.
5-to-1? So for every, you never listen, you need 5? I see you're tired. That was thoughtful. Thanks for making coffee.
That's the mechanism. And the motto is, small things often, regular deposits into the emotional bank account.
Which brings us to the second half of Kira's question. External stress. Because couples don't fight in a vacuum. The job loss, the traffic, the parent entering hospice. What does the research say about spillover?
Daily diary research confirms it. Stress experienced by one partner negatively impacts marital functioning the same day and the next day. It spills over. The stress partner comes home irritable, withdrawn, less able to turn toward bids. The other partner reads that withdrawal as rejection, and the internal conflict starts.
So the external stress becomes internal conflict.
That's the mechanism. And underneath, it's something physiological. The Gottman Institute calls it flooding, or diffuse physiological arousal. When stress exceeds your regulation capacity, your body releases stress hormones. Heart rate goes up, on average above 100 beats per minute. Breathing changes, and the mind becomes self-focused. John Gottman's line is, above 100 beats per minute, you won't be able to hear what your spouse is trying to tell you no matter how hard you try.
That's the part most couples don't know. They think the problem is that they're bad communicators. The problem is that their nervous system has left the building.
And when you're flooded, you're more likely to use the Four Horsemen and less able to show affection, humor, curiosity, or problem solving. The exact capacities you need for the conversation are the ones that shut down first.
So, what's the intervention?
The 20-minute rule. Gottman's research found it takes about 20 minutes away from the stressor for stress hormones to leave the bloodstream. So when a fight is flooded, the recommendation is to take a break of at least 20 minutes, not 30 seconds to collect yourself. 20 minutes minimum.
And there's a catch on what you're allowed to do during the break.
Right. You're supposed to avoid what they call righteous indignation and innocent victimhood thoughts, so you can't spend the 20 minutes composing your rebuttal or rehearsing how wronged you've been. You're supposed to do something soothing and distracting. Music, reading, exercise. Let the physiology reset.
You might nap.
You'd nap through an earthquake, but yes, napping would qualify.
The other piece for external stress is the stress-reducing conversation. The how was your day conversation, done correctly. What are the rules?
8 rules. Take turns. Don't give unsolicited advice, because understanding has to precede advice. Show genuine interest. Communicate understanding. Take your partner's side. Express a we against others attitude. Express affection. Validate emotions.
The we against others framing is the distinctive one. The outside world is the enemy. The couple is the team.
That's the opposite of what usually happens. Usually the stress partner comes home. The other partner says, "Why are you in a mood?" And now the outside stressor has become an internal fight. The stress-reducing conversation says, "Your boss is the problem, not me, and I'm on your side against the boss."
Give me the job loss example.
One partner is facing possible job loss, comes home irritable and withdrawn. The other partner takes it personally and starts a criticism cycle. "You never talk to me anymore." That triggers defensiveness. "I'm dealing with work. What do you want from me?" Escalates to stonewalling. Now they're fighting about the relationship when the actual threat is the job. The Gottman approach would be, the stress partner gets a stress-reducing conversation where the listener takes their side against the outside world, not a problem. Solving session about the mood, not, "Have you updated your resume?" Just, "Your company is being awful, and I'm on your side."
And here's the nuance I want to flag, because it separates this method from generic communication advice. The Gottman Institute explicitly says classic active listening, the paraphrase "back what you heard" exercise, often fails when couples use it on each other's complaints.
That's a real admission from a therapy method. They're saying the thing everyone gets taught in couples counseling doesn't work in the place everyone tries to use it. If you're mid-fight and you say, "So what I'm hearing is you feel unappreciated," your partner often hears it as a technique, not as listening. It's too late. The physiology is already flooded. But active listening works beautifully in the stress-reducing conversation, because there the topic is outside the relationship. You're not paraphrasing a complaint about yourself, you're paraphrasing a complaint about the boss. That's low stakes, and the skill actually lands.
So the method's position is, don't use active listening on your own fights. Use it on the outside world.
And use something else entirely on your own fights. The gentle startup, the break, the dream detective work.
This reframes conflict as partly a physiological problem, not a character problem, not a willpower problem, a body state problem.
That's the compassionate part. When your partner is flooded, they're not choosing to be unreasonable. Their heart rate is above 100, and their prefrontal cortex is on lunch break. The intervention is to regulate the body first, then talk.
And the method has its own critique of itself, which I appreciate. The divorce prediction research is famous, over 90% accuracy. But the treatment outcome literature is thinner, largely uncontrolled or quasi-experimental.
That's honest. The strongest peer-reviewed outcome studies are the 2017 study of 106 gay and lesbian couples, which found significant relationship satisfaction gains after 11 sessions. The 2018 Iranian study on marital adjustment and intimacy. The 2024 Norwegian study of 490 participants, which found the 7 Principles program improved relationships and was equally effective in person versus online, and equally effective with or without clinically trained therapists.
That last finding is striking. The material works even without a clinician delivering it.
Which suggests the mechanism isn't the therapist's charisma. It's the reframe and the techniques themselves. But there's no large-scale, randomized controlled trial of Gottman method couples therapy itself. The prediction research is observational. The treatment research is real, but modest in rigor.
A listener should know that. The method's fame rests more on its predictive power than on randomized outcome data.
And the predictive power is impressive. The turning toward bids finding alone. Newlyweds still married 6 years later had turned toward each other's bids 86% of the time in the lab. Those divorced 6 years later had turned toward only 33%. That's a massive gap from a tiny behavioral measure.
86 versus 33. And happy couples turn toward each other about 20 times more than distressed couples during everyday non-conflict discussions. The small moments are the whole game.
Which is why the motto is, small things often, not grand gestures. The accumulated micro-decisions to turn toward instead of away.
So, if Kira's couple is sitting at home tonight, rough patch, recurring fight, external stress piling up, what's the concrete sequence?
First, learn to recognize flooding. If your heart is pounding, if you can't think straight, if you're rehearsing your rebuttal, you're flooded. Call a break, minimum 20 minutes. Do something soothing, not something that keeps you angry. Second, when you come back, use a gentle startup. I feel, I need. Third, figure out which kind of problem you're fighting. If it's solvable, solve it. If it's perpetual, stop trying to solve it and start building dialogue around it. Ask what dream is underneath your partner's position. Fourth, if the stress is external, have a stress-reducing conversation. Take your partner's side against the outside world. Don't give advice until they've felt understood.
The 5-to-1 ratio is the maintenance dose. 5 positive interactions for every negative one, especially during the rough patch.
Especially then. Because the rough patch is when the ratio collapses, and the collapse is what makes the rough patch self-perpetuating.
The method's answer to Kira's question is, you don't fix the recurring fight. You declaw it. You don't solve the stress. You build a we against its structure. And you regulate the body before you try to regulate the conversation.
That's the summary, and the evidence base is real enough to take seriously, with the caveat that the treatment research is still catching up to the prediction research.
On that note, the 20-minute rule sounds simple, but there's a wrinkle.
The break isn't the intervention. The return is. I did intake coordination for a couples therapy clinic in the early 2000s. My job was administering the Gottman questionnaires and coding conflict sessions through one-way glass. 3 months I lasted. Kept getting flooded myself watching the fights. Had to step outside and breathe. But I noticed something. The couples who took the 20-minute break and then just sat back down and resumed the same topic, they'd reflood within minutes. Heart rate back up, horseman back out. The break didn't do what the manual said it would. The couples who did better had a re-entry ritual. A phrase. A hand squeeze. Making tea together before sitting back down. Something that marked the return as a new conversation, not a continuation of the old one. The ones with the ritual stayed regulated. The ones without it didn't. I started telling couples to pick a re-entry phrase before they took the break. Something like, okay, fresh start. Or, I'm back, I love you. It felt silly to suggest, but it worked more often than not. Then I tried the 20-minute rule on myself. Fight with my partner. Set a timer. Spent the entire 20 minutes composing increasingly elaborate mental rebuttals, point by point. I had a whole closing argument ready. Timer goes off, I walk back in, and I'm angrier than when I left. That's when I understood the righteous indignation instruction. It's the hardest part of the whole method. The break only works if you actually stop fighting during it, and most people don't. They just fight silently.
The break is necessary, but insufficient. The return is where it either holds or collapses.
The re-entry ritual is a repair attempt. It's a signal that the fight is over and the relationship is still here. That maps onto the repair attempts research. Coming back together after a break with an apology or a gesture builds trust and safety.
What I'm wondering is whether the ritual works because it's a ritual, or because it's a shared signal that both partners agreed on in advance. The agreement itself might be the active ingredient.
Could be. The couples who picked the phrase together did better than the ones where I suggested it, though I only saw maybe 30 couples total, so I'm not publishing anything. The tea thing worked well. Making tea takes about 4 minutes. By the time the tea's made, you've been back in the room together for 4 minutes without fighting. That might be the whole trick.
That's a nice observation. The ritual buys you a short stretch of non-conflict co-presence before you touch the hard thing. It's a transition buffer.
The 20-minute rule has a hidden component. The break resets the physiology. The ritual resets the relationship.
I'd put it that way, if I used words like that. I just told people to make tea.
The method's own material says to avoid righteous indignation and innocent victimhood during the break. But it doesn't tell you how. You've got to have a plan for what you're going to do instead. Most people don't.
Which is why the break fails. You can't just not think about the fight. You have to think about something else, and that takes a deliberate activity.
I read a magazine once, during the break. Just flipped pages, didn't absorb a word, but it kept my mind off the rebuttal long enough for the timer to run out. Anyway, the couples who got it, they got it. The ones who didn't, they were back in my office the next week with the same fight and a higher heart rate.
Kira's couple needs a break plan. Not just a break. 20 minutes, a soothing activity, and a re-entry ritual agreed on in advance.
That's a useful addition. The published material gives you the 20 minutes and the warning about righteous indignation. It doesn't give you the return protocol. And your field observation is that the return protocol is where it either works or doesn't.
I wouldn't call it a field observation. I was just watching through glass and taking notes.
The most interesting adjacent detail I found in the research is the 2024 Norwegian study. 490 participants, and the Seven Principles program improved relationships equally well whether it was delivered in person or online, and equally well with or without clinically trained therapists. Which raises the question of what the therapist is actually for.
That's the open question I'd leave listeners with. The method's fame rests on prediction. The treatment evidence is thinner, and yet the material seems to work even when nobody's delivering it. So is the mechanism, the reframe itself. The dialogue skills, the ritual of doing something together, we don't fully know.
The reframe that recurring conflict is normal and the goal is dialogue, not resolution, is something most couples never hear. The question is whether declawing an issue is something couples can do on their own, or whether it needs the structured container of therapy. The Norwegian study hints it might be more portable than we thought. The small things often motto deserves the last word. 86% versus 33% on turning toward bids. 5-1 on positive to negative. The small consistent actions might matter more than any single conflict resolution technique.
Thanks to Kira Lindqvist for the prompt and for the work she does. And thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed it, tell a friend or email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.